The following Dharma talk was given at Boundless Way Temple in Worcester, Massachusetts. The temple is an affiliate of Boundless Way Zen, a multi-lineage school of Zen Buddhism. So continuing this morning with our exploration of Layman Pang, or Pang Yun, as his full name was. He was, as David and Alan talked about yesterday, one of our only illustrious lay ancestors. Of course, I think we had thousands, if not millions, of lay ancestors, but in all the stories and the sayings and doings from Chinese Chan history, he stands out. And some of the things I'd like to highlight about him before I look into another story about him and his family, maybe a couple of other stories, is that he was a kind of a regular guy, a Chinese scholar, and someone who had held down a job and was probably employed by the government until he encountered Zen. And there are many, many stories about him meeting various Zen teachers. As Alan mentioned, he especially studied with Shito and Matsu. So these teachers who were the founders of both of the still living lineages in our modern day Zen practice, the Soto school and the Rinzai school. And I was interested to notice when I was looking at the record of Layman Pang, which is many, many stories about him and his encounters with these two teachers and also with his friends. He had lots of friends in the Dharma. He would wander from monastery to monastery, temple to temple, and engage in dialogue with a lot of different people. There are many stories about him doing those kinds of encounters, which have a very different flavor from the dialogues about him and his family. They're more traditional, puzzling koan kind of encounters, and I'm not going to look into any of them today. But it is something interesting to me that he didn't start studying with his first teacher until he was 45 years old. So not only was he a layman, but he was someone who got off to a later start than was usual in that time. We read of Zen teachers from that period in China, starting when they were kids or when they were teenagers or when they were very young, and you know, decades and decades of monastic practice combined with ordination. He wasn't like that. He already had a family. He already had a job. He already had lived a number of years. 45, I figure, in those days was very different from what 45 might feel like right now in our modern day. So already a householder who had grown children, someone who had succeeded at his job. And apparently the legend about him and his family is that after he had actually a number of great awakening experiences with both Shito, Matsu, and other people, he convinced his family to give up their, what I imagine to be a comfortable life in the city. And they took all of their belongings and put them on a raft in the middle of a lake and sunk the raft. And then the four of them went off to make their living as basket weavers. The wife, the son, and the daughter. So many of the stories of them, of the family, revolves around their wandering life as basket weavers. Imagine, if you will, you yourself finding the Dharma and then saying, I'm just saying to your family, I'm just going to take all our stuff and put it on a raft in the middle of the lake and sink it. Pretty extreme thing to do. But you know, on some level, maybe compared to people giving everything up for the Dharma and going and becoming monastic, not so different really, but he found a very unique way to do it. And his family came along with him, which is also not that usual, as many of us know. I've been reading a little bit also about the Buddha's early life, And one view in the book I've been reading is that he kind of did the same thing. He got all excited, went around and met a whole bunch of teachers and learned what they had to learn. And then after his great enlightenment, which happened after he left all those teachers behind, the rest of his family, who he'd also left behind, all came to join him and essentially play in the Dharma with him. His mother had died when he was born, so this was his stepmother and his wife and his son and cousins, all kinds of people from his family came to join him. So this, in this way, I think that the Buddha himself was a little bit like Layman Pong. After an initial departure, a return, but under new circumstances. Come and join me in the deer park, the Buddha said, and they all came. Come and join me in giving up all of our worldly goods, and they all said yes. What an interesting thing to have happen. So we know that Ling Zhao, Pang's daughter, was brilliant in her own right. We don't hear as much, as Alan said yesterday, about the son, Ling Zhao's brother. We hear some about the wife, but there are a lot of stories about Ling Zhao and her brilliance. And I want to read one of them to you right now. Maybe we'll get into another couple, but we'll see. But this is very directly related to the story that we worked with yesterday. And just to remind you of that story, Layman Pong is studying the sutras and he says, difficult, difficult, difficult. It's like trying to store pounds of sesame seeds at the top of a tree. Sometimes that translation is different. It's like trying to place one sesame seed on every leaf of the tree. And then his wife says, easy, easy, easy. It's like getting out of bed in the morning and putting your feet on the floor. And then Lin Zhao does her little, it's both and it's neither thing, which we talked about yesterday. It's not difficult, it's not easy. The teachings of the Buddhas and ancestors are written on every blade of grass. And David and Alan gave a lovely talk about that story yesterday. So this, you might say, is part two of that story. One day, Layman Pong asked his daughter, Ling Zhao, some ancients said, clear and brilliant are the meadow grasses. Clear and brilliant is the meaning of the ancestral teachers. How do you understand this? So this little line is another version of not difficult, not easy. The teachings of the Buddhas and ancestors are written on all the grasses. Clear and brilliant are the meadow grasses. Clear and brilliant is the meaning of the ancestral teachers. And Pong says to his daughter, how do you understand this? Ling Zhao's response is, so old and great, and yet you talk like this. Anybody who's ever had a teenage daughter can flavor that the way you would like. So old and great, and yet you talk like this. Layman Pong says, what would you say? Ling Zhao says, clear and brilliant are the meadow grasses. Clear and brilliant is the meaning of the ancestral teachers. And Layman Pang's response was to laugh. So you can get a little flavor of a relationship that was both equal and not equal. The daughter, the father. The father asks a question. This is not different from student and teacher. The teacher asks a question. And the student responds in a very surprising way. Ling Zhao says, you're so old and great. Maybe she said, you're so wise and wonderful, but I love that it begins with, you're so old. And yet you talk like this. In other words, we have a note in some of our koans from Yamada Koan, I think it is, about how making a big deal out of anything in the Dharma is making it dirty, making it filthy. Why talk about it at all? Why muddy the waters with words? Why do you even bring this up to me? So old and great, and yet you talk like this. You're still saying things that might lead people to misunderstand. Some ancient said, clear and brilliant are the meadow grasses. Clear and brilliant is the meaning of the ancestral teachers. So old and great, and yet you talk like this. And then Layman Pang, I hope really sincerely, you have to read between the lines, you have to get inside the character, feel your presence. If you asked a child who was interested in what you were studying a question, and they sort of insulted you, he just says, what would you say? Maybe that's a kind question. Maybe it's really, truly curious. Well, that's what I said. That's what some ancient said. What do you say, you young person, you person who's just been studying the Dharma for a little while, not as long as I have. I've been with Shito and Matsu and all these other people. You've just been with me. What do you say? And what would you say is the ideal question, really, in any encounter? What would you say? Because that's a question that we have to ask ourselves whenever we hear any of these stories about the ancient ones. You have to put yourself right inside. You have to use your imagination. What would you say? What would you do? How would you respond? And Ling Zhao does something that that we teach in our koan study, which is flavorless words. Flavorless words are words that say the same thing, but without adding anything extra. So much the same thing that you don't vary what you say at all. So flavorless in the sense of not adding any extra spice to the recipe. It's just the simple thing itself. Ling Zhao repeated what Layman Pang quoted the ancients as saying, clear and brilliant are the meadow grasses, clear and brilliant is the meaning of the ancestral teachers. Layman Pang laughed. And what can you do but laugh? There are the words again. But her words, she owned them. And of course, whether that other story about the difficult and easy happens before or after this dialogue, it almost doesn't matter. This was something that the family talked about, maybe at dinner in the evening when they had finished their basket making and their basket selling and they settle down. Imagine those conversations. So I'm just going to end this little talk with reading about Layman Pang's death. He lived to be in his 60s, so he was about 20 years into his study of the Great Way when he died. We don't know what was going on with him, whether he was sick or something else was happening. But when he was about to die, he said to his daughter, Ling Zhao, go outside and look at the sun so you can find out what time it is. Just when it's noon, when the sun is directly overhead, come and tell me. So Ling Zhao went to the door and looked out, and she said, the sun has just reached noon, but there's an eclipse. Come out and see it. Layman Pang went to the door and looked out. And Ling Zhao snuck over to her father's seat, placed her hands together in gassho, and died. Layman Pang came in, saw that she had died, and smiled and said, my daughter's deftness, or my daughter's cleverness. This is a very interesting story. And these stories that we hear of people just dying in the moment that they choose to die, supposed to be a sign of great achievement, that you can just decide to die. You breathe out and then you just don't breathe in. This is what Ling Zhao did. Layman Pang decided after this to put off his death for another 7 days. Imagine having that much control, kind of interesting. The governor of the province where they lived came and asked about him. Heard about Ling Zhao's death, gave his condolences, and asked him about his condition, his physical condition. And Layman Pang said to him, I just ask that you regard everything as empty. Don't give substance to what doesn't have any. Farewell. The world is full of reflections and echoes. And then he put his head on the governor's knee and closed his eyes and died. That's his death. So interesting way to approach life and death, interesting way to approach relationship. I love that little moment when he puts his head on the governor's knee, this impoverished layman, this basket maker, this person of the way. Gives a little Dharma talk about emptiness and then dies, and dies for real. He was cremated and his remains were not buried. They were scattered around all of the lakes and rivers in the area. Everybody mourned him and said, as Alan said yesterday, that he was like the great Indian lay teacher Vimalakirti. And then his poems were all that was left of him, and the stories that we're telling this weekend, all that was left of him. So clear and brilliant are the meadow grasses. Clear and brilliant is the meaning of the ancestral teachers. Right now, in this moment, what do you know for sure? How would you say it? Thank you. So please make yourselves comfortable, and we'll have our Dharma dialogue. You can respond, answer that question, talk about anything that's coming up for you, maybe related to the talk, to Layman Pang, to the talks yesterday. And both Alan and David and I will do our best to answer you or respond to you in some way. So just raise your Zoom hand. And we'll start with Anne.
Thank you. That was beautiful, especially the stories at the end. I'm glad you included them. But I got stuck in the beginning. Did you say that talking about the Dharma was thought to muddy the waters? How do we have all this talk about the Dharma?
Sometimes we say after you give a Dharma talk, you should wash your mouth out with soap. because what we're trying to talk about is beyond whatever we can say. So we're pointing at something and causing trouble.
Yeah, I think I was quoting Yamada, who said that about, you know, adding words, right? It makes it dirty.
Many words have been added, though, since.
Oh, my goodness, that's for sure. Right.
And the other perspective is, you know, you have to say something. And so we say these words as to touch and guide and provoke all of us on this journey, but yet not to mistake the finger for the moon. It's not the words, it's not the teachings, it's not anything other than life itself. Yeah.
Thank you. Will.
Thank you so much for the talk. I don't know, I've been interested in Zen for long enough and done enough reading and listening that most things I feel like, oh, one of these. But I have to say, I've never run across this story of, I mean, I've heard of Layman Pang, but I've never run across the story of his daughter. And I was completely surprised. And I'm glad, I mean, that that's just very, very interesting what she does, right? He's about to die and she knows that. And then she says there's an eclipse. Do we know whether there was an eclipse? I missed that. Or was she?
I don't know. My fantasy about this is that there wasn't. She was
there's
just
no
trying
eclipse.
To get him out of the way so she
but
could.
But either way, so then she goes to his
the
chair.
Punch. Yeah.
And I guess, I mean, this may just be my association, but, you know, there's a Greek myth of Alcestis that her husband is told that he has to die. And he tries to get someone else to die for him. And he says to his parents, you know, you guys are really old. Why don't you die for me? And they're like, no, I don't think so. Each one, right? Nobody will do it. And his, I forget whether she's his fiance or his wife. And she says, yeah, I'll be your substitute. And she dies for him. And it's this very resonant thing. And I thought, is that what Ling Zhao is doing? And in a way, yes, right? Because he was ready to die at noon, it sounds like.
Yeah.
And then he put it off for a week. I don't know, I'm just astonished. That's all I have to say. I'm astonished.
Yeah, wonderful response. That's a great response. What would you say? I'm astonished. And you know, the playfulness of their relationship. There's another story I didn't tell that I just want to mention. Some of you know it. They were out once selling bamboo baskets, the layman and his daughter, and he came down a bridge and he stumbled and fell. And when Lin Zhao saw it, she ran to her father's side and she threw herself down.
Oh, I like it.
And he said, "What are you doing?" And she said, "I saw Papa fall to the ground, so I'm helping."
Oh, I love it. I love it. I don't understand it, but I love it. Thank you.
Right, right, exactly. It's very, very layered. And then he says at the end of that, he says, "It's a good thing no one was looking." No one saw it, right? So what are they doing? The astonishment is very important. That doesn't make logical sense at all. If somebody's hurting, you don't hurt yourself. If somebody's dying, you don't die yourself. But maybe that Greek myth points to something too. Yeah.
There's a way too, Will, and this was what was coming up for me as you were speaking, that you know, they start out as father and daughter, so different levels, you know, very different hierarchy, but they end up in some of the legends, they end up, those two, the father and daughter, end up wandering together, and they're wandering together when this death experience happened. And it's as though they've gone from here to here, and they become equated. And it's almost like they're each other's male and female principle. You know, she's his prajna in the tantric sense, the manifestation of female energy in Pong. And Pong is, it's like the Tibetan Chenrezig Zentara, the two sides of Avalokiteshvara when they moved to Tibet. So there's, to me, there, I guess I'm trying to say there's something almost mythic about what happens to father and daughter in the legends.
Yeah. Esther.
So thank you so much for the talk. I was so moved, and I felt like I was taken right into the village where this was going on. Mm-hmm. And you know, the image of putting everything on the raft and sitting it out to sea or the lake and let it burn, you know, whether it's all the content of our life at this moment or ideas about something or anything at all, you know, that very strong imagery really moved me. And then the weaving of the basket as the main thing they did and how everyone followed along, this strong trust. Now this is what we do as a family. And, you know, almost like this weaving a basket where we hold the Dharma. Like it became very sort of inside of me, outside of me at another time, still very alive in this moment, in my time, in my family.
Yeah, I like what you say, Esther, about inside of us and outside of us, these images, these stories that we, teaching stories, right, touch us in some way beyond what we can actually comprehend, but our heart is touched, and this idea of giving away everything we have and this being a wandering basket weavers. And I think some dream of the whole family coming. Not everyone's sons and daughters and partners are on this external path. But maybe in some way too, when one person practices, the whole family practices. And in our hearts, we do travel with those that love us than those that we love. And we weave baskets together as we have dinner and argue with each other and try to get to the bottom of it.
And also the reminder to really listen to each other and to listen to what we say and put out. And then, you know, as the teenager responds or the spouse responds to, sometimes maybe very helpful just to get the same words back or to really there was something that was like, the simplicity, the listening.
There's a version too, Esther, of the boat story where this was not intentional. They had all of their boat because they were moving or something, and it sank. And so then the story is that they just went with it. Like, okay, let's make some baskets. And I like that version of it too, just this flexibility and no clinging at all.
I love the image too of everything weaving together, you know, so Alan gave us a male, a female, but really all these elements just come together in such mysterious ways. You know, every one of us has all the elements. We're the fathers, the sons, the daughters, the mothers, the teachers, the students. And so to keep that going, that little metaphor of weaving, so many elements to make a beautiful basket, which might sink or get, you know, burned up. We just can't control.
Burst up in flames.
In fact, everything ultimately does. Yeah, thank you. Dawn.
Thank you very much for the talk. I just had something come to mind. It was about the words muddying the water. If we don't muddy the water, how will the mud ever settle on the lotus flower seed so it can grow?
Yeah, because to say that things muddy the water is to kind of get lost in purity, which is a real trap, right? We need the dusts of the world, and the lotuses need their mud.
I love that image, Dawn. And maybe it's just what Alan was just talking about meeting what happens. You know, we say muddy, we think, oh, well, that's really bad. But of course we need muddy, and this image of this lotus seeds growing, they don't need clear water with no mud. They don't need purity, cannot thrive in that. And maybe all of us. So if any of you have been confused or feeling muddy through this retreat, maybe that is a good sign. I'm sure probably very few of you, but appreciating the mud.
I've been using the word today, discombobulated, to describe myself. Muddy, discombobulated. But you know, there's another aspect to all this too. It's not that different from what you're saying, Dawn. If we didn't have, going back to Anne's original question, if we didn't have those words as pointers, we wouldn't be here. These stories are inspiring. The teachings are inspiring. And we also don't want to make the finger more important than the moon, as David was saying. Yeah, so it's always that movement. Things are very flexible. Nothing's so rigid.
Yeah.
Yep. Thanks. Thank you. Barry.
Thank you for the talk. I seem to be in a very heavy place in this session. And I went to a place of grief when I heard this story, because the saddest people I've ever known are those who have lost a child. And the layman survived 6 days, which I would imagine would be 6 days of grief. But given his profound practice, perhaps his emptiness relieved him of that. But it hasn't for me.
Yeah. Well, and I don't think we would want it to, right? In the sense that everything is the Buddha Dharma. Grief is the Buddha Dharma. Loss is the Buddha Dharma. I had thought last night when I was thinking about this talk, you know, the Chinese have a saying, grandparent dies, parent dies, child dies, good fortune. Child dies, parent dies, grandparent dies, bad fortune. Yeah, so he got to live those 7 days, and I doubt that he was that he didn't have a lot of feelings about it. It wouldn't make that much sense. But I also think it's really interesting, you know, to settle into this story, just settling deeper. What was going on for Ling Zhao that she tricked her father into taking his place? What an interesting thing. I'm not asking you to answer it now, but it occurs to me that there's layers of this story to explore.
Well, the other place I go is, dying. We talk a lot about the great death, and many religious paths, many spiritual paths talk about dying before we die, right? In a sense, as we sit in Zazen, each one of us is Ling Zhao. Each one of us has taken our father's, our mother's place in some way. And is it possible to be the raft that sinks? Is it possible to abandon the story of the self, right? And this great generosity we teach in Zen, who knows what happens when the physical body dies, but in this moment, there is death and rebirth moment after moment after moment, and great sadness arises and great joy arises. Can we practice dying? Here, someone earlier said, I think it was Brad, that he's back in the saddle because he suspects he may die. Probably not, Brad, I'm sure, but we all will certainly do this. If we can die to ourselves, die to our idea of who we are and how it should be, there is a great freedom then, birth and death. We can clap our hands, cry and laugh all at the same time.
You know, it's interesting to me too, the way that just now I connected the death story to the first story that Melissa told us about Ling Zhao and the layman. And it's almost as though, you know, Layman Pang explains to Ling Zhao, so I'm going to die at noon today. And her response, which she doesn't quite articulate, is so old and wise, and yet you talk like that. And then his response, which is not said, is so how would you do it?
Yeah, right. And
he does say, you know, when he comes and finds her dead, he say another version of what he says is still, you know, still ahead of me.
right, still ahead of me. Yeah. And you know, I'm myself always, I think I've been interested in how to live fully in the middle of a life that's full of death. That, you know, this is what I did when I worked at hospice. The thing that we kept saying, this came from Elizabeth Kubler-Ross, she had a book called To Live Until We Say Goodbye, that in the midst of death, we're alive, always alive. And I feel like Zen practice really points us in that direction. And it doesn't mean you should be cheerful all the time and laugh and beat drums. You hear stories like that too. But that you should weep when the weeping comes, and rage at the sky when the anger comes, and you know, and when the denial comes, just turn on the TV. You know, this is life unfolding. There's no pure version of grieving. This past month, I've lost a few people, more than normal, I guess you'd say, people very, very close to me. How do you deal with that? Do you just compartmentalize it and say, no, la, la, la? Do you feel it when it comes, and that's your practice then? And then when it recedes, do you run after it? Lin Ji tells us very directly, don't run after it when it leaves. So whatever comes, comes, whatever goes, goes. And all of it is the Buddha Dharma. And I love what Alan is saying about, you know, the intimacy of these two at this point. They didn't even need to say these things anymore. Everything was implied. Everything was completely implied. And that's what a deep deep connection is, so that when somebody dies, the process of healing the grief is to allow them to complete that integration. So everyone who's gone is still here. And we move on to the next loss. Yeah. So anybody else before we close this Dharma dialogue for the day? All right. Thank you all. And please take your seat once again for a few moments of practice.